So in a few minutes we'll be having our first talk of the conference. It will be done by Ian Gent, and it's on solving patience in solitaire games with good old-fashioned AI. So I've known Ian for a long time. Aside from an all-round great guy, he's done many, many different things related to constraints and AI and combinatorial optimization. So because I'm kind of lazy and couldn't remember everything, I wrote it down in my little notebook I got for the conference. Everyone has one of these, hopefully. Actually, I nearly didn't have it after noting this list. Ian and I were upstairs in the Modref workshop yesterday, and I inadvertently left it there. But when I went back, it was still here. So write your name. It's a good tip. People don't swipe it. So it seems to be unscathed, so that's good. So I wrote a list. Let me see. I have wrote a list, some research contributions of Ian Gent. Oh, what? It seems to say brilliant stuff done by the genius Ian Gent. I don't know what happened. Okay, we don't really have time to go into that, but some things Ian's worked on, and each of these are bodies of work, so multiple papers in each. So satisfiability, he did a lot of work, both in theory and in practice, algorithms. Modeling different problems and quite a lot of puzzles, so you'll see that today. General reformulations with Conjure, Savile Row, and all the work around these general reformulations. A subject which is close to my heart, bin packing. So if you've never read it, I highly recommend the Ian's paper, Heuristic Solution of Open Bin Packing Problems. It's one of my favorite papers. I go back and read it. I think it's almost as good as 1984, which is one of my favorite books. But it might be actually slightly better because you can read it in 1 hour and it doesn't give you a feeling of hopelessness at the end. And there are no rats. So what else do we have? We have a lot of things. So phase transitions and constrainedness. He's worked on quantified Boolean formula, empirical studies, a big advocate of reproducibility in empirical studies. The minion solver. Many papers around this, different aspects. There's a whole raft of work on symmetry breaking. Co-creator of CSPLib, just goes on and on. And what's this? What? Inventor of large neighborhood search? Okay, I guess we should just get on with the talk and maybe something will be clarified in the meantime. So,
okay. Thank you.
It's a great pleasure, Ian.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction, which I wrote.
I didn't write it, he was lying.
Can I just, I very kindly, some of my colleagues from Scotland are sitting in the back row because they wanted to check the acoustics. Can you hear this okay? Yeah, good. This is my standard joke for the situation. You may steal it. You will really know AI is successful when you can walk into a room, plug in your laptop, and start giving a talk. Okay, so many thanks to Paul for that introduction. Is this going to work? This might start animating. Yes, so there, just while I'm saying a couple of things, this is an animation of the game of Klondike, which I'm going to talk most about in this talk. My name is Ian Gent, I'm from the University of St Andrews. And I do not claim to have invented large neighborhood search. Right, so you may have played this game. This is one of these talks where I can't go into too much detail about the game. I'll give you a few sketches of what the rules are, but we're going to win this. You know, I chose one we're going to win, unsurprisingly. And you can move things at Doctor 3. I'll take you through a few of the rules in a moment. And are we going to win? The tension is unbearable.
This is an astonishing room to give a talk in. I meant to say that. What an amazing, and thanks everyone, to all the organisers and everything. And like, as I was walking here, somebody sent me a picture and was like, you're joking. I had no idea it was going to be like this. So, oh look, we've won. Thank you. Well done. Yay. Okay.
Fun fact, my URL is ian.gent. There are not many audiences who care or be impressed. Hopefully, this is one of them. Some of the people in the room will be going, you're joking. No, it actually is. Ghent is a region of Belgium, and they started a top-level domain, and I bought Ian. And if you go to ian.gent, I haven't done anything very interesting with it. It actually redirects you to my university page, but if you click on the picture of Klondike or the link next to it, you'll get links to the slides, to where the Solvitaire solver is, other things of relevance. So hopefully you don't need, there are no QR codes to give you links in this talk. The link is ian.gent and click on the Klondike image. There are going to be a lot of fun facts in the talk. If I give a talk, I'm going to go onto random diversions. So on this occasion, I've tried to plan many non-random diversions and have fewer random ones. Okay, so this is based on two papers. I was doing this last night and I realised it's based on two papers. So I'll put it in the talk. So one of them is about to be resubmitted to JER, i.e. this has not been published, it's on archive. You can get it at the link, the paper is on the link, ian.gent, click on Klondike. If I hadn't been preparing this talk, it probably would have been resubmitted. It was rejected. But here's a fun fact. The original was rejected from JER. Possible one of the reviewers is in the room. Possible three of the reviewers are in the room. This is possibly the kindest comment I've ever had on any paper ever. This paper, I also enjoyed that this paper has soul. They formatted it in the way they thought would work best for their work. I've missed off the word reject from that. It did say reject in the same review. But, well, I really love that. And this talk is the same. I'm doing it the way I think works, so apologies if you don't like the way the talk is. And the other one is a paper that Jack Waller presented yesterday. So you may have seen it at the ModRef if you were there. If you didn't, I'm not going to go through it in detail, but I will come back to it near the end. So here are the people that those two papers are joint work with. I've highlighted on the left the two who were St Andrews, students, undergraduate students, not doctoral students. That's Charlie at the top, Jack at the bottom. I was going to say that if Jack ever applies to do a doctorate with you, because he just finished his degree, then grab him because he's wonderful. But then he said he might consider doing a doctorate in St Andrews, so actually don't take him, it's terrible. And on the right, we've got Nguyen, Pete, and Felix. So Nguyen and Pete are here. Felix is celebrating his 25th wedding anniversary somewhere else. I like to give acknowledgements early in the talk because I'm very likely going to run out of time. Pete, about an hour in, Paul is going to start going like this and I'm going to start looking over there. I'm joking. The talk is planned to finish on time. But I like to get the acknowledgements in early because I might run out of time and not get to acknowledgement. So I get them in first, and then we thank all the people, many, many people here, some of them in the room. EPSRC for support. We used about 30 CPU years, generously donated by the UK National HPC Service. And I'm just going to highlight three people at the bottom who are all sadly dead. They're unsurprisingly my parents, but there are specific reasons. It's not just, oh, my parents are wonderful. I'll tell you why later on. And then atop that, is a man called Jon Walter, who's sadly also died, and I'll talk more about him later as well. Okay, so I also like to get to the conclusions first, so that you can see the conclusions while you're still awake, and then the rest of the talk will be going through the conclusions. So, this is the talk in one slide. The most famous single-player card game is called Klondike. That was one we had an animation of. In general, single-player card games are called solitaire games in America, patience games in Britain. So depending on the history of the English language, where you're from, they're called that.
There are hundreds of patience games. So there's not just one, like Klondike, there are hundreds. And we've built a solver called Solvitaire, which can solve many, many, many of these. And this is what the talk is about. And on dozens of patience games, including Klondike and many others, we've got by far the best results in the world to determine the winnability of those games. And it's a Solvitaire, so we better tell you how Solvitaire works. One of the most remarkable things is, having got all those amazing results, for every game we ever got results on, the input is just a basic JSON description of the rules of the game. So it's not hardwired, optimized for each game. And it is a classic example of good old-fashioned AI, and it's going to have depth-first search with some GoF AI add-ons, transmission table symmetries, dominances, and streamliners. But it isn't perfect, so we can improve it with constraints. And there's one big open question I'm going to get to right at the end. I have a feeling it's my connection, I don't know. Okay, so I'm going to now go through so you know where we are. So the most famous single player card game is called Klondike. You've already seen it running. But I'm going to take you through in slightly more detail. But again, there is a limit on how much detail I'm able to give in the talk, obviously. But I will take you through some of the key concepts. Oh, here's a fun fact. In 2020, Microsoft Solitaire, which is a descendant of Windows Solitaire that used to be on every computer, that was getting played 100 million times daily. So probably in the modern age, Solitaire is now not as popular as it was 15, 20 years ago. Still 100 million plays every day. And that's just one program, because it phones home. Okay, so there's a layout. What can we see? Well, the foundations. So we're trying to get the cards to get up to the foundation. So we're going to get the ace of spades and then the two of spades and so on. So that's the goal. And we want to get them all up to king. That's the tableau. So the tableau is that area where there's a seven piles of up one to seven cards. That's a face-up card. Those cards are face down or hidden. You can't see what they are, and you can't move them. This is the stock, and that stock is, it physically would be a pile of cards, and you turn it up three at a time, and you put it on the waist. So let's see that. Some moves happening. Ace of spades can go up because it's the ace of spades. That's fine. That has turned the hidden card face up. The two of spades could go on the ace of spades. And now that's created a space. Nine of spades can go on the ten of diamonds because you can put a card in the tableau on another card if it's one higher and the opposite color. And that reveals that four of clubs. That's called face up, and that's called a built group. We can move three cards from the stock like that. We could put that four on that five. I'll speed up slightly. We could do multiple moves of the stock. So this is going to do four moves in a row in one slide. And then when we've done that, oh, look, we can put a king in the space. And in this game, you're only allowed to put kings in spaces. You can't put other cards in spaces. I've moved on a bit through the animation. So this is an interesting thing. I've added this slide last night after discovering that people don't know about this. There's a wonderful move you can make in patience sometimes called worrying back. So we moved the seven of clubs up to foundation. We're actually allowed to move it back onto the eight of diamonds. And that is a standard rule of Klondike, which is almost certainly implemented in your solitaire program. It's not an undo, right? That is not an undo. It is a forward move. We're moving the seven of clubs to the eight of diamonds. So you do that, and that, you get that, and then you can carry on. In this case, you actually need to do it, because they're later going to use the red six, move that black five onto it. Okay, and then we go on and on and on, and we win. And then we get some kind of animation, usually, like that. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So we're going to just take a break to... Oh, here's a fun fact while we're doing that.
He's a teddy bear. And now he's having Abby. It's a mascot. It's going to help me stay calm if anything stressful happens in the talk. Probably not going to happen. But should anything stressful happen, my teddy bear will help me keep calm. But the fun fact is, Annie Gabby was at CP95. So 29 years ago, CP, the first CP, this is the third CP. So me, Annie Gabby, probably some others in the room, have been first and 30th CPs. Probably won't mean anything to anyone else, but Paul might be interested. I'm pretty sure that at CP, which was on the beach, not on a beach, but next to the beach, Patrick flew Annie Gabby on the kites. I didn't bring juggling balls, unfortunately.
Don't you know? It is.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Fun fact, this happened. Yes, thank you. Fun fact. Also, no, maybe it's in 1994. Maybe it's in 1994. Oh, sorry. Now I'm back. Just to continue with this, this reminds me of when I applied for a lectureship and got it at Strathclyde University, where Paul was a student. During my talk, we had things called overhead projectors, and I was in this lectureship talk, and the overhead projector went off. So we switched the light, and the other light didn't work. So this happens sometimes on occasions which you might think are stressful, but you just keep going. And then they go, wow, that was impressive, that guy carried on, it was okay. And then you get a job, it's fantastic. Didn't hurt that I was the only candidate. Right, so we just finished a game of Klondike, didn't we? Right, so let's continue. So. I've mentioned the most famous single player is Klondike, but there are hundreds of other patiences. I'm not going to show you hundreds, I'm going to show you seven or six others. So I call this game Klondike. There's a lot of confusion about names. Some people call Klondike Canfield, okay? But Canfield is the name of that game, which I am not going to explain in detail. But Canfield is sometimes called Demon. But Demon is also another name for Klondike. Okay, fun fact, that's my mother and father. My mother called Demon was the name my mother... Demon was the name my mother used for Klondike, and Demon is the name my father... Sorry. Demon is the name my mother used for Canfield, and it's the name my father used for Klondike. And I just want to highlight, I don't know if this will work, not quite. If you can spit unclear, this is my mum and dad at my wedding 30 years ago. He's wearing a monocle, so the tradition of superb dressing style continues father to son. Okay, but Klondike, some people just call Klondike Patience. But Patience is also the generic name for these seven games and many, many others. But also, some people call that Solitaire. That family, Americans typically call that Solitaire. And then on the other hand, some people call that Solitaire. It's just a mess. There's infinite names for everything. So I'm going to be clear. If I say Patience or Solitaire, I'm talking about the family of games. And one is British and one is American. And when I talk about an individual game, I'm going to call it the proper name, Klondike. The only good thing, well, not the only good thing, but one of the good things about the internet is we more or less have an agreed name for every game now. But the rules still vary. So you may load up an implementation of Klondike and it doesn't have worrying back or something like that. But obviously, when we're doing checking we've got an agreed set of rules, and you can go and check the rules for every game. This is one of the wonderful things about patience. I used to work on random problems, and nobody cares about random problems, except in patience and solitaire, where people deal out random layouts of cards and they want to know if it's winnable. And when I say people care about winnability of patience, I really mean people. In the 1990s, there was a thing called the Internet Free Cell Project, before there was a good free cell solver, and people, there were exactly 32,000 deals available in Microsoft Free Cell. People wanted to solve them and know if they were all solvable. It was an open question. Eventually, they got together and people solved each one individually, and other people checked the solutions, and they decided that all but one were possible and the other one was impossible, and they were correct. And that was a fantastic early example of crowdsourcing. How early an example, I hear you ask? 10 years before the word crowdsourcing. So the OED says the word crowdsourcing was in 2006. These people doing it 10 years before that. Another kind of person who cares about the winnability of patients is Percy Diaconis is a famous statistician, also somebody who studied the mathematics of shuffling cards. And he gave this wonderful quote, which is forever we're in the debt of people who gave you quotes like this, if you work on this area. It is one of the embarrassments of applied mathematics that we cannot determine the odds of winning the common game of solitaire. An embarrassment of applied mathematics. This is a top applied mathematician saying this. That was in 2005 in this paper, and he and his colleagues worked on Klondike, and they got the winnability estimate down somewhere around plus or minus 10%. Okay, so they did new work to get it down to there, right? Because they said it was embarrassing. Actually, it's plus or minus, we've now got it to plus or minus 0.084%. So it is 81.945%. plus or minus 0.084. What I mean by that is the 95% confidence interval is that. That is 100 times better than Percy Diaconis' estimate. And it's also 30 times better. When I say 100 times, I mean in terms of the width of the confidence interval. And it's 30 times better than the best previous estimate, which is a guy called Matt Birrell. So I've greyed out the embarrassment. I don't think it's quite as embarrassing nowadays. What do we mean by winnability? I haven't said, because it is what you think it is. If I lay out random cards, what is the probability I can win with perfect play? One extra assumption that we make, and people like Percy Diaconis made in that paper, we're going to do what is called thoughtful. So it's thoughtful if you know where all the cards are. So if I show you this picture as a cheat sheet, and I tell you that is the location of all the cards, before you start, can you win? You can do this whether you're playing on a computer or on a table. On a table, you just look at the cards, right? If you're not on a table on your computer, most computer games have unlimited undos. So you just, if you use that freely, then you're playing thoughtful. Because you get to think, say, oh no, that's a seven of diamonds there. Well, then you undo it. Now you know it's a seven of diamonds. Another fun fact, oh, sorry, just before I get to the fun fact, here's something for you to think about. The answer, don't shout out, the answer will be later in the talk. Thoughtful isn't quite the same, almost but not quite the same, as playing with all the cards face up. Okay? It's almost the same, but not quite. See if you can figure it out. I will tell you in a few minutes. But just something for you to think about. Here's another fun fact. You can still look at that slide to see if you can figure it out. Thoughtful solitaire, the idea of thoughtful solitaire came from a president of the American Mathematical Society, and specifically this character, Irving Kaplansky. So these are, you know, we've had Diaconis, we've had Kaplansky. These are serious academics who work on this, and, you know, and me as well. Okay, so we built a solver called Solvitaire, which can solve many, many, many of these problems. And Solvitaire has got the world's best results on dozens of patience games. So our program is called Solvitaire. Solvitaire is one of the greatest names of anything ever. It was at least a computer program, because it's a solver for solid. Do you get it? Sorry, I think you probably got it. I've named a few things. One of them I'm proud, and some of these have stuck. So for example, there is a Wikipedia page for the Petri multiplier, which is the thing I named. And if you're wondering, Petri multiplier, that's a bit of a coincidence. I know Karen Petri, I've met her at lots of these conferences. Yes, it was her idea, I just named it. She wouldn't have named it Petri multiplier, I'm sure. I did. So when Charlie suggested the name Solvitaire, I was like, okay, you win, I give up, you're the winner, name. Except that's not true. I thought it was true, and then one day Charlie said, you know that slide you've got where you say you thought the name was great? You said it was terrible. So apparently, he was doing his project, and he said, what about the name Solvitaire? And I said, no. But obviously, he did win me over, it's a fantastic name. Okay, have I named anything else? You ask yourself, yes. This is my most best fun fact. I did not invent large neighborhood search. Our wonderful program chair invented large neighborhood search. It's absolutely fantastic. Don't know if you can quite see that. 2,000 and something citations. Who cares about citations anyway? You know? Oh my goodness me. He did this when he was working at Strathclyde with Patrick and other people. And he told me about this idea. I can almost see his head popping over the cubicle in Livingston Tower. And he's telling us about this idea. And I said, that's a great idea. It's like you've got a large neighborhood. Oh, why don't you call it large neighborhood search? And Paul can, so it's not, he has said on this stage I invented it, he's a liar, but if he was to tell you that I named it, that would be the truth. So I'm very proud of that. I would rather have invented the algorithm and he had the name, but you know, we can't have everything. Oh, I see. Oh, sorry, Paul just told me he wasn't lying, he's defending himself. In the text it said, Ian invented, quotes, large neighborhood search, unquote. So it was a true statement. Okay, so how are we going to do this winnability estimation? Again, probably not a surprise to anyone, but we're going to use Monte Carlo methods to do it. So typically we ran a million different random games. You look at the number of where you win, you look at the number you lose. Sometimes you time out, so those are indeterminate, and from that you can compute a 95% confidence interval. We do it very conservatively. So we go the lower bound assuming all the indeterminate ones are lost, upper bound is assuming they're one. So that's the 95% confidence interval. Monte Carlo methods were invented by this man here, Stanislav Ulam. Famous applied mathematician, possibly also famous for helping to invent the H-bomb, but that's not my favorite thing. But he invented Monte Carlo methods. If you're familiar with tropes, like TV tropes, if you ever spent months on TV tropes, wasting your life, there's a thing called Chekhov's gun. This is Chekhov's Stanislav Ulam. Okay? He's going to come back. This is foreshadowing, right? So keep him in mind. Okay, so winnability estimates. I've already mentioned this one, Klondike. So now I'm going to tell you, did you work out why thoughtful was different to regular? The answer is this going to work? Yes. If you look at this, you've got six of hearts, five of spades, four of hearts. You would normally be able to move that as one block. Okay, maybe you'd have to get rid of the four and six. But if you get rid of the, if you get rid of the four and six, and you've got the four of hearts, you're not allowed to move the five of spades, four of hearts combination. Whereas if you're playing it face up, you would be able to do that. That's an easy way to get a bug, if you don't think about that. Okay, here's another one. This one is called Canfield. This one is from Jan Wolter. We're 30 times better than Jan Wolter, who had the previous best result. I'm now going to start racing through these. I do apologize if you want to know more about these games. They're fantastic and interesting and lovely. Golf, that one is 45%. Both those came from Jan Wolter. I mentioned he died, sadly. What a great tribute. It's like people will have, what an epitaph to have. Somebody created this paint by numbers puzzle, which I did. and then you get his picture of him. So there he is. I've been very happy. I never met him. I didn't get into this before he died, but I have corresponded with his widow, and it's lovely. And I'm going to talk more about how great he is in a bit. Black Hole, some of my co-authors, we won't write a paper on this, but the best results now are from Solvitaire. This case were only twice as good as the best, previous best. King Albert, we got that percentage, which is 90 times better than Bill Roscoe, who's another sort of big academic. Fun fact about King Albert, it was my mum's favourite patient. She taught me to love patients, and she did it with extraordinary patience because we play together. And I would kind of gradually take over. I'd say, don't do that, just wait, I need to think about it. And I've got a fun fact, and I'm not going to tell you the whole story. I'm going to hold the whole story hostage. So the partial story is that if you can see there, that's a Second World War biplane. And you can just about see it's got three cockpits, okay? One, two, three in a row. There's a pilot and then two others. And they're all in the open air, right? In the Second World War, she was flying one of these, in one of the two back seats, in midair, swap seats. I'm not making this up, she did that. Exactly the full story, you're going to have to come and talk to me. This is my attempt to be sociable. So if you want to know the story, come and talk to me sometime during the week and I will tell you in more detail. Okay, late binding solitaire is this, 47%. That's from Ross and Knuth. Knuth, wait a minute, that name rings a bell, doesn't it? Knuth, is that a coincidence? Not so much. That is Knuth. I knew that Donald Knuth doesn't have an email address, which made me quite surprised when he emailed me and said, what is this solitaire game called? And I was able to tell him, it's accordion. And if you're thinking to yourself, did that guy really just put a whole slide up and an invited talk just to say he got an email from Donald Knuth? And the answer would be, yes, I did. Free Cell, it's that. That was the one that people solved by hand in the 90s. 99.99. So actually, if you ran this to five significant figures, this is 99.999%. That's one of my favourite numbers in science, because if somebody says 99.999%, they're either just saying, oh yeah, 99.999%, but actually that's the number for five significant figures. That is the winnability of Free Cell. And you can see, in this case, we're actually worse. Somebody else has done huge amounts more than us, so they've got it to 25 times better winnability estimate. That's a guy called Slimy Fish. So that's that. So there we have a picture. All of those are our Free Cell estimates. All but one of those are the best in the world, all produced by Solvitaire. The one exception is Free Cell. We were still not bad. We were still very, very good. So the one I'm embarrassed about, this is a nice thing to be able to say, the one I'm embarrassed about is the one that is plus or minus 0.0002%. That's the bad one. In the paper, there's actually some more games that other people have tried before. There's also 22 games that Solvitaire's got the first ever results for, and there they are. I'm not going to go through them. I want to mention a couple. People have cared about this in books going back to 1890, and some of those books have given extremely inaccurate results. There's a classic book from 1980 which says that British canister is odds in favour. You can win just over 1 in a million games. Right? On the other hand, somebody in 1890, and that is not a typo, it's 1890, said that fan with careful play is slightly against the player. Turns out it's 48.7%, which is slightly against the player. So that's incredibly accurate. So, okay, I mentioned we're going to use just a basic description of the rules in JSON. So it really is completely general compared to the typical cases where people wrote a solver for one game or Free Cell, but maybe different variants of Free Cell. And what I'm going to do in the next few slides is show you exactly the rules that Solvitaire works on for each game of the ones I've talked about. That's Klondike. So that's everything, the input that it gets for Klondike. The only thing I want to highlight here, which I'm going to come back to, is this partial if card above buildable. But I'll come back to that. But that's the set of rules for Klondike. that's a set of rules for Canfield, that's a set of rules for golf, black hole, King Albert, play Binding Solitaire, and Free Cell. And by the time you get to Free Cell, which is just tiny, you sort of think, hey, this is a trick, right? They're cheating. Okay? There's a slight trick. We've got default values. So if your game uses default values, you don't need to specify them. So Free Cell is mostly default values. So that's why it's so short. But that's the only trick. So if you don't provide the value, it uses default value, passes, fills it in with default values, gives that to the solver, and that's what it uses. It uses JSON description. And apart from parsing the JSON and storing the values internally, that's it. There's no cheating. It uses those rules at every node in the search tree. Okay, so now let me get on to how it works. Good old-fashioned AI, I don't know if you've heard this phrase, this is a Wikipedia quote, it's classical symbolic AI as opposed to other approaches, such as neural networks. I have a somewhat cynical view. So my world, good old-fashioned AI, we say, okay, we have a problem. We can only answer certain questions. We have to spend a lot of time answering every question we want to answer. LLMs go, you idiots, I can answer any question you like anytime, no problem. Okay? On the other hand, good old-fashioned AI, if we can answer your question, we give you the right answer. LLMs say, what is the right answer? Okay, that's the end of my bashing of modern AI. So we're going to do depth-first search, and we're going to need some optimizations, which I'll talk about in turn. So depth-first search, I'm not going to talk about in great detail because I kind of hope you know what it is. If you don't, we can tell you in the paper. And we really just trust it. We just do depth-first search. Right? We don't do things like try and do meta moves. Sometimes in games, you can think of it mentally by saying, well, I can move that block from here to there in five moves. But we don't do that because if you need to do the five moves, you can do them. Sometimes it gets utterly ridiculous. So we got one game where one unwinnable instance, we proved it was unwinnable with search which went to a depth of 27 million. Right? Depth of 27 million. So somebody, one of the reviewers said, are you saying you go down these deep rabbit holes? And my answer to that is yes, we're going down a huge rabbit hole, but we're exploring the whole rabbit warren. It's written in C++ by wonderful honors students and Andrews. We're doing training. I almost, but not quite, put up a picture of Christian Schulte because we sadly remember him. But he was an expert on how to implement depth first search, and we use the trailing approach. Every move destructively changes the state. We've only got one complete search date, but then when you backtrack, you undo the thing you did. So you always store the moves you made, and then you undo them. And every node in the tree checks the rules, which seems ridiculous. We've got code. If you're running Klondike, there's code every node in the tree saying, have you got any free cells? Oh no, the rules don't have any free cells, which sounds crazy. It just didn't seem to be important to optimize in practice, so we didn't. Okay, so here's now some of the optimizations. Transposition tables. Don't try a position you've tried before. So if you end up in a position on the left, at some point, keep a note of that and never go to the position on the right, because it's the same. So just in a bit more detail, if you're on the position on the top right, then there's no point trying the one at the bottom. And there's only two cases to consider. One is you backtrack completely, because we're doing complete depth-first search. So if you backtracked and you come over here, you know there's no answer, so there's no need to try it. And on the other hand, if you haven't backtracked yet, then it's an ancestor, and you've gone back to the same node twice and just going in an infinite loop. So again, there's no need to do that. So in either case, you don't. So we use a cache. This is totally standard in games AI. The RAM can be a problem. For example, I'll give you a few examples just as an illustration. So if we had a cache of 1 million, we had 492 timeouts. If we had a cache of 100 million, we had 38 timeouts. But when you use the bigger cache, you did get ridiculous RAM, like 67 gigs of RAM. So it's a trade-off. Symmetry breaking, which Paul mentioned I've done quite a lot of. If you're in the position on the left, if you've seen that one, there's no need to try the position on the right, because you just swap the kings over, which you can do in a legal set of moves, but there's no... If you've tried one position, you don't need to try the other one. So that one is pretty easy to avoid. It's an add-on to the cache, because we, instead of just checking a position has been visited, we check any equivalent symmetric position has been visited, and we do that by only storing the canonical representative. So you basically sort the columns under some order, and that's what you put in the cache. And that if we turn that off, you go from 38 timeouts to 195. Streamliners, this is a really important thing. We try to streamline the search. In general, this is a general thing that people have been working on. And the general idea is that often solutions have unreasonably well-behaved solutions. So problems often have solutions which are much cleaner than you have any right to expect. And in patience, the idea is, if you've got a move which is usually good, commit to it and don't backtrack on it, so you can go to somewhere else and search the place. Sometimes you lose, but if you win, you win. So the most common example in patience is, if you're able to move a card to foundation, then do it. Again, some people don't even know you don't have to do it, but you don't have to, you're allowed to wait. If you don't make those moves, most of the time, you're wasting time. But occasionally it makes a game that was winnable, unwinnable. But if it is, if you do the reduced search, it'll be much quicker, even to do complete search. But if the complete search says no, sorry, if the incomplete, if the streamliner search says no, you don't know the game is unwinnable, because maybe you had to do one of those moves. So we have to rerun without the streamliner on. So we've got this option called the smart solvability, where you run it for 10% time with the streamliner on, and then if that fails, you run it again with the streamliner off. And for example, on free cell, with a 5-minute timeout, that made a difference from 254 timeouts to zero. So obviously it's incredibly good. Dominances, this one, if you can make a move, if it's true that you might as well make a move, then make it. So I've got to be careful what we mean by might as well. So in this example, which we saw in the game, I moved the ace up. We weren't compelled to move the ace up. We didn't have to. We could have moved, I don't know, I can't see anything else we could have done. We could have moved the stock. Oh, the 9 onto the 10. We could have moved the 9 onto the 10, right? But at some point, we're going to have to move the ace up. And if we don't move it now, the only reason not to move it now is because we want to do something else with the ace. But we can't do anything else with the ace, so therefore, you might as well build it. Dominances are sometimes called safe moves. People in patience have used them a lot. And a dominant move is one that we can play knowing that if there's a solution at all, there's a solution where we make this move now. They're very important, but also incredibly bug-prone. We might as well move the two as well. I'm going to show you the general rule. I'm not going to explain it for reasons I'll tell you in a moment. So the general rule, this one, is you can move, in this game, the foundation, you can move a card to foundation if the foundations of the opposite color are both at most 2 below this card and the other foundation of the same color is no more than 3 below this card. Okay, and you don't need an explanation because, as Michael Keller says, you find this on the web, it's a clear and obvious rule. Okay, nobody ever proved this before. Everyone uses it. Nobody's ever proved it. We proved it. It's correct. Fun fact, the original version of the paper, so if you're in the room and you reviewed it, the original version of the paper said you really should prove, you know that thing you said nobody's ever proved? You should prove it. And we did. And they were right. So the fun fact is, reviewers can be right. You know, not a thing we always admit to each other, but reviewers can be right. And they help make your paper better. Okay, so I want to talk, we spent a lot of time on bug fixing, and I want to talk about that a bit now. We've got various different ways you could do it. So one of them is macroscopic. If I run Walter Solver, and I get a 95% interval which is different to ours and doesn't overlap, there's probably a problem. Often it's an R solver, or it could be an HIS solver. The microscopic one is when you've got them to line up, we start running them on the same instances. So we run an instance on HIS solver and run it on R solver, we look at the results. If one of them, if they both say yes, that's fine. If they both say no, that's fine. If one times out, that's fine. But if one says yes and the other one says no, we go and look at it. And we use a thing called, that I call punctilious precision, which I got from my father. You've had him on my wedding day, so it's only fair this is on his wedding day. He's wearing a monocle there as well, because he really is just that cool. So he wore a monocle, but saw further than anyone else. He found or helped to find the most distant object in the universe. That's a picture from the Guinness Book of Records from 1973. These things don't stay the furthest for very long. But it's an amazing thing to have done. And his attitude was punctilious, tenacious precision. So let me tell you about that. I'm waiting for anybody to spot the typo. It was genuinely a typo. You can see it now. And I thought, that's too good to edit out. We spent huge amounts of time looking at Jan Walter's code for Canfield. It was enormous fun. I'd love to talk about all the 12 iterations of bugs we found in his code, in our code. I'm not going to. Everything I'm talking about now, although I haven't told you about Canfield, applies to Solitaire 2, to Klondike 2. So here's the most ridiculously complicated one. So he had a dominance which said that you move the card to foundation when the penultimate card in the stock satisfies the conditions I told you earlier, the clear and obvious rule. And it's almost right, but it's not right. And I'm not going to explain this, but let me just read it out so you get the vibe of how complicated it is. This is when it goes wrong. When you play the penultimate card in the stock by this rule, but much later on you play the third card in the stock, revealing the second card in the stock, which you must not play immediately. But if you don't play immediately, you can never play it, so you lose. And if we hadn't followed this rule, then we could leave it in place as a placeholder. When you play the third card in the stock, it's eventually replaced by that card, and you move it then, and then you can play it. I hope that's clear. I am not going to explain it more. Here's the point, though. This happens. There's a random deal where Jan Walters gave the wrong result because he had this rule. So it really matters in one out of 50,000 cases. So, here's another thing, and again, I've got vivid memories of talking to Charlie, and we found this thing in Jan Walter's code, and we said, this has got to be wrong. So Jan Walter had this rule, I'll use this again, said, so you're allowed to move the 8 of clubs and 7 of hearts from that red 9 to that red 9. That's a legal move, okay? Jan Walter said, don't do it, unless the only way you need to do it is if you move that 8 to there and immediately put the 9 of diamonds up to foundations. So that's his rule, okay? Well, obviously in this case, you can't move the 9 of diamonds up to foundations, so you're not allowed to make that move. And that's the rule. When I said in Klondike, we had partial if card above buildable, that's that rule. And Charlie and I were convinced that was wrong. And we totally failed to come up with a counterexample, either by thinking or by running examples. So eventually we gave up finding a counterexample and instead we proved it's correct, which it is. So now this is a correct proved rule. If we have those two dominances, you go from, if you turn them off, you go from 38 timeouts to 481. And this is where I want to be super nice about Jan. I cannot emphasize this enough. This is a dominance that we found, was in, the only way we knew about this dominance was we found it in the code of a dead guy. Right? This is how we found out about this dominance. He made his code open source. You can still get it. Okay, now you can't. Okay, now you can get it. And so because we could look at his code, we could improve our solver, we could reproduce his results, we could debug his solver, and we use this code, this dominance, that's where we found it. So open source, let your code outlive you. This reminds me of a time I was giving an interview for a job. Oh, is it back? Sorry, I'm going the wrong way. Okay. Oh, I think I put this one in the wrong place. Oh. No, I didn't. Right. Okay, so I'm not explaining, sorry, just I did get slightly more thrown by that one. Open source, let your code outlive you, a slogan to live and die by. So one thing you can do with software, because it's genuinely just rules specified in JSON, you can just change the rules, right? So here is 9 variants of Klondike. The middle box is standard, the others are variants, and it can do fantastically well. Pay no attention to that one in the bottom left corner, where it does terribly. 51% plus or minus 48%. That is quite a large, that's 2% to 99%. So we used patience, so we used constraints, because there are games like that where it's really bad. And you can have games, so I will explain why this happens. So here is a position in regular Klondike. Now imagine that everything except the bottom two cards are hidden because you haven't revealed them yet, but we know what they are. The 6 and 7 have the property that you, the 6 and 7 diamonds have the property. You can neither move either of them until one of them has moved, which means you can never move either of them. Why is that? The 6 of hearts, well, we could put it on the black 7, but they're underneath the two things. 7 of diamonds, we could put it on a black 8, same problem. Oh, but we could put the 6 of hearts on foundations, except the 2 of hearts is blocking it. We could put 3 of diamonds on foundations, except 7 of diamonds is blocking. So this is a position which cannot be solved, but Solvitaire will thrash on, because it doesn't use constraints. So this is a problem, and so we have written constraint models which address this, but it's still difficult because constraint modeling for Klondike is hard, and for example, you don't know how many moves it's going to take. So we don't actually have a complete model of Klondike. So what we've got is we solved a relaxed version where those blocking steps still fail it, but it's much more easy to compute when you win. But if you could win the relaxed version, you might not be able to win the real one, but if you can't win it, you know you can't win the real one. So we did that, and using constraints, this is the big news of the talk, we reduced the probability from any 1.945 plus or minus 0.0084% to 0.081%. Okay, no. Right. Okay, this was in our that was in our ModRef paper if you were at the talk yesterday. Not in the ModRef paper, because since we did that, we went to that version, which is in that bottom left corner, where it was 51% plus or minus 48%, and we now know, thanks to constraints but not Solvitaire, that 72% of those are unwinnable. Still leaves a gap from 0 to 28%, but it's a massive improvement, and obviously we can do better in the future, I hope. So we're very nearly there. One huge open question remains, and I haven't really talked about it yet for a simple reason, I have no idea how to address it. What if you don't know where the cards are? And what if you're not allowed to peek? And what if your program doesn't give you an undo button? What is the probability? We've definitely got an upper bound, 82%. Right, you can't do better than 82%. The best claim I've seen for lower bound, somebody claims they can get 43%. That is literally a person who said, I played 400 games and I won that percentage. I'm not saying I don't trust that person, but we don't know. I think the highest percentage I've seen from a program is 35%. So maybe the 43% is plausible, I don't know. But it means we've got plus, point, minus, whatever I said, 0.1% accuracy on the thoughtful game. Unthoughtful game, it's a factor of 2. We do not know to a factor of 2 what it is. In theory, it could be 81%. There might be some magic way you could play it. Probably not, but we don't know. And we may never know, because how do you prove that you can't do better? So you can prove, if I have a strategy and I run a lot of it, I could say, oh look, I can get 42%. Doesn't mean I can't get 43%. So I'm finally, this is not like me, I'm going to finish on time. And finally, the most fun fact. Do you remember Chekhov, Stanislav Ulam? Okay, so Monte Carlo method. This is an amazing thing. I would love to say I found this out myself, but it was Anders Solomon who told me. It's just astonishing. Right, so that guy's Stanislav Ulam. He invented Monte Carlo methods. Why did he invent them? He was in bed, he was playing Patience, playing a game he called Canfield, and he started thinking, how many times are you going to get this out? How many times can you win? He was convalescing from an illness. And he started thinking, well, if you have this, and then, you know, so he started trying to do maths on it. And that was too hard. And he thought, yeah, why not? We've got computers now, this is like late 40s. Why don't we program a computer to play it, see how many times it wins? Lay out 100 random deals, see how many times it wins. And that made him think, oh, Monte Carlo methods, let's do that. We've used Monte Carlo methods to do exactly what they were invented to do by this guy who didn't have the capability to do it. And fun facts, going back to some of the fun facts we've had, he played a game called Canfield. I do not know what that game was. It might have been Canfield, it might have been Klondike. But whether it's Canfield or Klondike, we have improved the state-of-the-art knowledge of the winnability by a factor of 30, whichever one it was. So that's how good Solvitaire is. And we did a thing that this guy thought of doing. I think that is it. I've got to my acknowledgements. These are wonderful people. I've told you about some of them. Any questions?
So it seems really challenging to find dominances from a given, like a just given a set of rules in JSON. So
are you? Sorry, I'm just getting terrible echo. I can't actually hear you. I mean, I can hear you, but I can't. Okay. I'm going to just come closer.
Okay. So dominances given a changing set of rules seem very challenging. So are the only dominances about the foundation or the whatever it is, the place where the cards go in the end, or do you have other dominances?
So yes, it is challenging. That's one of the big things. That's one of the smaller open questions. We've got exactly those two dominances in the game, in the solver. The one, the new one that came from Jan Wolter, you have to specify it in the rule set, which is why I showed that in Klondike, right? The other one about moving up cards to foundation, we do automate that because we look at the rules and we say, okay, it's red, black, and blah, 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 blah. But those two is what we've got. So coming up with new ones, there was a really nice example, actually. There's a game called Wormhole, which we invented purely for the purposes of showing we could invent games in this. And so we gave the results. And in the first draft of this paper, we said, we've got Solvitaire and we can use this to prove this new rule. And then somebody else said, oh, I've thought of dominance for Wormhole, which makes it better. So now the best results are not from Solvitaire, they're from the other guys because they put in a dominance. So the difficulty is making sure you've got it right, and you've got to be super careful, as we've shown.
Ian, thanks for a wonderful talk, even for non-card players. I was just wondering about the bugs. So are the bugs stupid code kind of thing, or many of them are to do with algorithmic logic issues, like the rules being wrong or something?
Right, so I think, sorry, just because I didn't catch every word, I think the question is, are the bugs like subtle things about patience games, or are they like bugs? You know, bugs in code. Both is the answer. You get the ones where it's like, they're more interesting when it's like, in this weird situation, one person thought you could do this, and the other person says you can't do that, or, you know. but there are lots of bugs which are like, you know, the C++. Oh, there was one bug in Jan Wolter's code which was like, I looked at it for days and eventually I found it, and then I showed it to Chris Jefferson, who actually knows C++, and he went, oh yeah, look, that's stupid, isn't it? Right? Or we had one where, for example, you could accidentally change the rules by bug. So for example, if we allowed you to put a king on an ace, to build a king on an ace in a loop, then you could win some games, which is strange. But so I think that's, I hope that's answered the question. Or I can talk to you later.
Since you brought up the dominance cache at some of the earlier slides, could you elaborate a bit on how do you decide which entries do you evict, which do you keep in the cache once you hit the memory limit? What are the trade-offs, and what was your computational experience with it?
Okay, so in the cache, how do we choose what we keep? We keep every state except states which are where dominance applies. So if you've got a state where dominance applies, you can just do it, because if you ever see it again, you're going to do it again. So therefore, you can throw those ones away. But we do keep every state. When I said there's a limit of the cache size of 100 million, if we fill that up, we start throwing them out on the least recently used basis. That's just a trade-off. You don't want to give up if you don't have to. It'd be nice to keep those states. And the more you keep, the more you reduce search, but the more RAM you use. So there's this trade-off there. And also, we probably could have a much better implementation of the cache, to be honest. It's probably a bit inefficient. But yeah.
Okay. As I understood the Monte Carlo approach, sometimes you have unknown result because it time out. So I was wondering if you made any time approach where you see the convergence of your estimation, and maybe there is a trade-off between the timeout for one solving.
That's a lovely question, because we did do that, in fact. So the question was, can you, you know, as you're going along, you've solved 1,000 games, and you know, you've with a 5-minute timeout or something. Well, then it's like, well, my estimate is now this, and then you can consider whether to continue getting. You might be better to get many more instances, but you might be better to get longer timeouts to resolve more. So actually, early on, Charlie in his dissertation did exactly that. We didn't do it for these papers, because we just ran them lots and lots and lots and lots. And so if we tended to do it by eye, so if we're getting a good percentage solved, we just carry on. If it wasn't, we'd give it more time and things like that. So it's quite unprincipled in terms of this paper. But Charlie in his thesis, he did exactly that. So he had a thing where it made a estimate any time whether to increase the timeout or to just do more instances.